Just a note before we start, this season of How to Fail with Elizabeth Day was recorded remotely under lockdown. I wanted to take a minute to introduce you to a new podcast that I am loving at the moment, because at this time, we need community and connection more than ever. Words and stories that bind us, not divide us. And that's why I am loving Anthems. It is a podcast of original manifestos, speeches, stories, and poems from some of the country's biggest activists, artists, and personalities, all contemplating what it means to be human. Season 2 just launched with 30 podcasts over 30 days in daily mini episodes from exclusively LGBTQI plus contributors, including Lottie Jeffs, Raven Smith, Shah Elise, and Ben Hunt. The episodes are a perfect addition to your morning routine at home. 30 podcasts over 30 days in daily mini episodes from exclusively LGBTQI plus contributors, all about what it is to be human. You just can't get better content than that. Search Anthems now wherever you listen to podcasts and check out the new season dropping daily across the month of June. Hello and welcome to How to Fail with Elizabeth Day, the podcast that celebrates the things that haven't gone right. This is a podcast about learning from our mistakes and understanding that why we fail ultimately makes us stronger. Because learning how to fail in life actually means learning how to succeed better. I'm your host, author and journalist Elizabeth Day, and every week I'll be asking a new interviewee what they've learned from failure. Samantha Irby is the brilliant essayist who gives voice to the unsayable. NPR has called her a side-splitting polemicist for the most awkward situations, and her work is full of wit, acerbic insight, and frank confession. She has published 4 books, the latest of which, Wow, No Thank You, entered the New York Times bestseller list at number 1. It details her life at 40, her marriage, and moving to a small town in Michigan for her wife after being a city dweller all her life. The collection also includes a deeply hilarious ode to her smartphone and an analysis of the potency of a 1990s mixtape, as well as dealing with the day-to-day struggles of chronic illness, racist neighbours, heavy periods, and maintaining mental health. The book is dedicated to an antidepressant. Irby's life has not been straightforward, and although I'm sure she would dispute the label, it becomes clear reading her work that she is an extraordinary person. In one of her most moving, powerful essays, My Mother, My Daughter, published in 2012, Irby details how she became her mother's carer at 9 years old, after her mother, Grace, had a car accident that accelerated the aggressiveness of her multiple sclerosis. Both her parents died when Irby was a teenager, and she dropped out of university. In 2008, she started mining the raw material of her life to begin writing on MySpace. But it was her later blog, Bitches Gotta Eat, which blurred the lines between diary and essay, that brought her wider attention and eventually a book deal. "My writing has been my saving grace," Irby once said. "Most bad things I don't write about right away. I've got to get a little perspective and reframe it. But if you can't laugh at it, it eats you up. I can find the humour in anything if you just give me a few days." Samantha Irby, welcome to How to Fail.
Thank you for having me. That is maybe the nicest description of me and my work that I have ever heard. Oh. So thank you so much.
I'm so
pleased. I was listening like, who is she talking about?
Well, it is all completely accurate. And I'm so pleased then that I was able to convey how much respect and admiration I have for your work, but also how hilarious it is. And that thing about saying the unsayable, I want to make it clear that that in no way makes your essays inaccessible. In fact, It's completely the opposite. And I don't know quite how you manage that, but is that a tone that you've always just been able to nail?
I think because I kind of dive headlong into it without thinking or planning, that it doesn't feel like taboo or shocking or anything to me until someone reads it and says, can't believe you said that. And then I'm like, which part? So yeah, I've always just been like, let's peel off the Band-Aid and like throw out the filter and talk about whatever. And it doesn't feel as scary to me, or it doesn't even feel remarkable to me until someone is like, I can never say that. And then I'm like, oh, well, I will say it for both of us. How about that?
It's interesting because historically women have been taught to feel so much shame for talking about something that is so real and pertinent to a specific female experience. But it sounds to me like you don't feel that shame.
So I think I am a person who has been and still is in some ways like deeply guided by shame. Like I feel ashamed all the time. And my way of getting out of it, or my way of trying to lessen that, is just to be as honest as I possibly can, because the hiding of things feels more shameful than admitting to it. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Like, that makes such sense.
It's like, I think like the things that we're ashamed of can feel so burdensome that for me, the act of talking about it is just like, I don't know, taking off a straitjacket or something. It's just like, well, it's embarrassing, but if I get it out there, then it's out there. And at least I feel embarrassed by it, but it's not weighing me down or holding me back.
And you have written about absolutely everything. You've written about living with Crohn's disease and having digestive issues on a date. You've written in the new collection about having what sounds like the most horrific heavy period in a hotel room. I mean, there are no limits, it seems to me. And yet your writing in so many ways is antithetical to the idea of role models. But you, Samantha Irby, it strikes me, are often held up as a kind of role model or a spokesperson or someone to go to when someone needs a quote on the body positivity movement. And I wonder how you live with that disconnect.
I mean, I hear role model and it makes me laugh, right? Because I think like, for who? You know, like, oh God, who, please, who? But the way that it, I mean, the thing that makes me able to accept that is I just think being a role model for a very specific kind of like dirtbag, gross person, then I will accept that title. Like a role model, but for like real disgusting people who like laugh at fart jokes, like that. I can be a role model for those people. For the greater public, I don't know, but for a very specific lane of people, yes, I'll accept it.
Does it get tiring then being asked by well-meaning mainstream journalists to speak for entire intersectional groups of people?
No, I mean, I'm always happy when anyone asks me anything. It makes me feel important and wise. But I always am like, this is, you know, everything I say is very specific to my experience. Honestly, like, I don't know enough to speak really for anyone other than me. I'm always baffled by people who, like, take up the mantle of other folks, because I'm like, it takes so much work to know things about anyone other than yourself, which is why I'm the only person I write about. But yeah, it doesn't feel tiring, although I don't think that I can do it. Maybe there are people like me to whom this applies, but mostly I'm just speaking for me.
I realize I'm starting off with some very heavy duty questions and I'm really sorry.
No, like, this is good.
I just want to get them all in there. There's so much I need to ask you. Okay. I love that quote that I ended the introduction on, that you said about how your writing has been your saving grace, but most bad things you need to have time to process before you can reframe. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I think a lot about in regards to failure, that sometimes a failure can happen to you and it feels soul crushing and gut wrenching mm-hmm. and unrecoverable from. And I always say that it is okay to sit with the grief of that failure for however long it takes, and then to come to a point where you can choose to attach meaning to it or not, whatever works for you. But I think that's super interesting. Do you have a kind of series of processes that you go through in reframing? Like, do you recognize the process now and the form it takes in your own mind to reframe something?
Yes. Well, so there's an essay in the new book where I tried to make a new friend and then an embarrassing thing happened to me. And when that happened, I immediately was mortified and I was like, oh, I'm never going to recover. I don't know if I can make it. It happened in a restaurant. I don't know if I can make it out of this restaurant, let alone have a friendship with this person, because I've humiliated myself so badly. So that happened. And by the time I got home, I was like, okay, that was embarrassing. But
yeah,
a couple days from now, I'm going to write this down and it's going to be really funny. Most things, I mean, I don't have very many these days, absolute devastations. So the little things, the little humiliations, the little anxiety situations, the turnaround on those is pretty fast. But I mean, when I wrote about my parents, like 10 years had passed, or more than 10 years had passed at that point, and it felt like I had enough perspective to really get in there. I think for me, it's like, if when something doesn't make me cry anymore or make me want to cry or have that pit of my stomach feeling, then I feel like I can write about it. And some things, I mean, it takes years for that feeling to go away. There are some things I don't think about because I'm like, ooh, nope, still not far enough from that. But as soon as the pit is gone, as soon as I can find the kernel of something funny in whatever situation, then I can start processing it and working it out in my writing. Some things I process, and if there's nothing useful for anyone else, I just kind of leave it. I'm like, well, that's a thing I went through. You know, it's character building or whatever. Some things don't get shared because I just think, like, who needs that? Or who's that going to serve? Who is that going to serve? But things, if they can make someone laugh or I feel like someone can learn, not learn from them, but can maybe relate to them. I mean, that's what I'm always trying to do, is like put things out there that'll either make people laugh or that they'll see themselves in and be like, okay, I'm not the only idiot going through that. Great.
Yeah. Aside from the brilliant content of your essays, there are two things that I really love about you. One is your unapologetic use of the caps lock key. You love capital letters.
Oh my God. I do.
So do I.
So many people hate it, but it's an incredible tool for those of us who love to shout.
Yes. And it's humorous. It's so funny. For some reason, it's so funny to see it. These big unapologetic capital letters in the middle of such as normal text. But the second thing I love about you is that you are a reality TV fan. And in your acknowledgements, you mention Luanda Lesseps, who, for the uninitiated amongst you, if you're listening, is the breakout star, really, from The Real Housewives of New York, which is the best thing, I believe, on television. How long have you watched The Real Housewives of New York, Samantha?
First of all, I mean, I knew that we were going to get along, but I mean, I might propose to you at the end of this.
Oh my gosh, I'd be delighted. Yes, already. Yes.
Glad we took care of that.
Yeah.
The New York Housewives is absolutely the best show on TV. Oh. I've been watching from season one. Mm-hmm. You will appreciate this. Your listeners might be like, shut up. But my friend, I just bought... Do you know what Cameo is?
Yes, like of course.
Okay. So I have a friend who is obsessed with Kelly Bensimone.
Yeah.
And she is on Cameo. And I bought my friend a message from Kelly Killoran Bensimone. And she, I asked Kelly to give her a pep talk. If she still has it, I'll send it to you.
Oh my God, please.
It is unhinged. And it's exactly what you think it is. It's worth $50 or whatever I had to pay for it. It's incredible. So I've been watching that show from the beginning, and Luann's transformation. First of all, I love a person who is all about manners. Mm. Like, I think I have good manners, but I don't, like, know etiquette. And so I appreciate that Luann is, like, the staunch etiquette person. But her transformation from, oh,
Countess.
Like, hoity-toity. Yeah. Count. I was trying to think of, like, a nice way to say uppity. But, like, she was, like, stuck up and horrible. And now she just is drunk all the time and trying to bang dudes. And it's incredible. I mean, I feel like we have been on a journey with her. And she's been there from the beginning. She's incredible. I tried to go see her show, but I could not get tickets. It was sold out. And I was like, Luann, you deserve it.
But this is why I adore you and Roxane Gay, because you are such intelligent women and you make watching The Real Housewives an intelligent act just by doing it. And I think the thing about Real Housewives of New York, that one of the things that I think is so great about it is that it is women of a certain age. The youngest woman on that show is like 43 and Ramona is now 60, and it tackles stuff that you don't see in scripted drama. You don't see a woman kind of openly talking about dating through the menopause. And it's just so good.
It is so good. And that's a thing people don't bring up enough, is that they are 60 and menopausal and having hot flashes. And we get to see them as sexual. We get to see them as fun. We get to see them kind of letting it all hang out in all ways. It's incredible. I mean, I am not enough of a scholar to write text about the sociological impact of The Real Housewives of New York, but I would commission a real scholar to do it.
Yeah.
Because it really is, like, in this day and age, to watch a bunch of 50 and 60-year-olds running around town, like, trying to date is incredible.
Thank you for that, Samantha. Okay, I will now get on to your failures. And thank you for mentioning Cameo, because I recently used Cameo for the first time, and it's a service where you can go and book, like, B and C list celebrities to do personalized messages. And it was my best friend's 40th birthday in lockdown, and I got her a message from Amber from Love is Blind on Netflix. Oh, and it went down a storm.
How was it?
Oh, it was incredible. I mean, you've seen Love is Blind, haven't you? I think I saw that you wrote about it somewhere.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's an incredible gift.
Yeah, she was so brilliantly on brand. I mean, she admitted halfway through the message that she was really drunk. And she couldn't, like, read my name and stuff like that. It was brilliant. Anyway, we digress. Failures. Samantha Irby's failures. Thank you so much for these three failures. The first one, I feel like, you know, it's quite a tone change now. But I feel like the first one I touched on in the introduction, which is that you failed to complete college. And it sounds like there was a very good reason for that. So tell us what happened.
So it's so funny to think about this, like, at this age. But for being a, you know, smart person who liked to read books, I did not love school. And I was probably better at testing than I was at doing homework and doing all the things that get you good grades. So by the time time came to apply for colleges, like, all my friends were like, I'm going to Yale and I'm going to Brown and I'm going to all these other fancy schools. And I was like, oh, I have like a 2.7 GPA. I'm going to go to state school. So I went to Northern Illinois for a year, and halfway through the year, my dad died. And then I finished the year and came home, and my mom died shortly after that. And I was like, okay, I am not going to go back to school. I'm like, I am from the suburbs. I'm from this town called Evanston, which is just north of Chicago. It's where Northwestern University is. Mm. Where Meghan Markle went. She's now our big claim to fame. It's the kind of place where a lot of kids, they talk about college often and you're expected to go. So I was an anomaly in my friend group dropping out. But I bring it up now. I mean, I think about it and talk about it now because, you know, I think we don't talk enough about how it's okay to be like an hourly clock punching person. I've always had jobs. I've always like been okay and done my writing on the side. So I don't have a degree to show off, but yeah. I've managed to do okay without it.
Have you ever been in situations where you have felt the lack of that college degree?
Oh, all the time. Even now, I mean, no one's going to parties now, but like you go to parties, you go to dinner and people are talking about events. And I'm like, I don't know geography. I don't know where anything is. I don't know anything about anything. And if people wanted to talk about reality TV or like memes, I would be okay. But people start talking about the news and I'm like, oh my God. I don't know anything. So sometimes I think, you know, when people are discussing things, I'm like, oh, not that going to college 20 years ago would help with what was on the news yesterday, but I do feel sometimes my topics of discussion are lacking, especially when among like erudite people who like to talk about smart things. But generally, I just surround myself with idiots, so then we all just talk about dumb stuff. Like, all my actual friends are stupid, so it's okay.
It's the ideal solution.
Yes. Yeah. I'm like, oh, you have a PhD? No, 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 we cannot be friends. Nice to meet you. Where is your moron friend? Because I would like to hang out with them.
But you mentioned that, almost in passing, about your parents dying shortly one after the other. And what was it about that that made you come to the conclusion that you were going to drop out of this course? I mean, that's probably a really stupid question. What wasn't it about that? It probably changed your world.
No, it isn't at all. I mean, it gives me the opportunity to talk about another thing that we, you know, I think sometimes gets glossed over in the how do you put together a life of it all, is that like I didn't have a safety net. And one of the things, even with like just going to school, is where do you go home to on winter break? Where do you go home to on spring break? What do you do over the summer? And so with them both dying and I was technically an adult, I didn't have answers to those questions. And maybe I could have investigated like loans or other ways of supporting myself. But, you know, I came from working class people. And so the only thing to my mind was, okay, I got to get a job. And so I got this job working in a bakery. And I lived with my sister for a little while, but she had two kids and a husband and was like, you know, out of the nest, out of the nest. And so I worked at the bakery for a while and I was like, okay, I'm getting a regular paycheck. I can pay half the rent if I get a roommate, you know, I can put life together. And I think both not really having any options of where to go and what to do, but also finding that like I could be responsible and get a paycheck and pay my bills. Like those two things kind of converged and I was like, okay, I'm not going to go back to school. I'm just going to keep working and get an apartment. And I don't know that I thought start living, but essentially start real life.
Because it strikes me that, and actually I'm going to quote you back to yourself here, which is a nauseating thing that interviewers do, but that essay that I mentioned, one of my favourites of your essays, My Mother, My Daughter, and if anyone hasn't read it, it's available online and it's just an astonishing piece of work, starts with the sentence, "My mother became my daughter when I was 9 years old." And it just strikes me, listening to you talk, that you had been required to be far more adult than your age for a long time, but you were living someone else's life. And maybe it felt like stepping out of college was like, finally, I can live my own life. I mean, how long had you felt, if I'm not overstepping here, that you were having to adult your own parents?
Oh, I think from age 9, I mean, my dad was kind of off being an alcoholic and not really having a place to live. And I mean, he kind of was in and out, mostly out of my life. So it was just her. I lived with my mom until I was 13, 14, my freshman year of high school. And from 9 to 13, it was basically me being the mom and her not. I mean, she just couldn't do much of anything. Like, once her multiple sclerosis came out of remission, she was pretty incapacitated. And so I was doing a lot of the things that she should have been doing. And L, right? Like, when you think about a kid at 9, it's like, even if a 9-year-old came to clean my house now, I'd be like, get out of here. You're just going to make it dirtier. So it's not that I was even doing a good job with all of the stuff I had to do. I was just trying to keep our heads above water, pretty much. And part of that was like keeping it hidden how bad we were struggling. But yeah, from 9 to 13, I pretty much was parenting her.
What happened when you were 13?
See, here's the thing. I'm a storyteller, but I just like dropped off the story. She went into a nursing home when I was 13. And then she had an accident at home where she fell early in the morning, like right after I had left for school. And then I stayed after school. I mean, who even knows what I was doing? Nothing useful, I guarantee that. So I got home late and she had been on the floor all day because she couldn't get up. And I had to call an ambulance and she was in the hospital for a while. And the hospital was like, yeah, you can't go back to your apartment. Like, we need to find a nursing home for you. So she went into a nursing home and then I kind of bounced around between like foster situations until I graduated from high school.
I'm so sorry you went through that. And I find it...
Oh, thank you.
No, I just find it so remarkable that you are who you are. And you say in wow, no thank you, that you've never had therapy.
That first year of college, like my dad died in February and I had a little bit of an emotional breakdown then because I had to do all of the funeral stuff and it was a lot. And then I came back to school, had a little bit of a breakdown. Then I started seeing, like, you could go see a student therapist. So like during that time I had like a brief counseling and the woman's name was Gabrielle. I still remember. She was really great. And then after that I was working and I mean, I was making like $7.25 an hour and no benefits. There definitely wasn't money for therapy. So I just kind of didn't do anything. Tried to joke my way sane.
I mean, I'm sure you've been asked this a million times. It's the most unoriginal question of all time. But do you think that writing began as your therapy?
Unconsciously, yes. I mean, you know, I started really writing on the internet to get dates, well, to one person, and then I dated him, and it flamed out and was bad, and then I was like, oh, forget this, and then my friends were like, no, we read that, start a real blog, And then I think once I really started doing it and kind of like processing all of these things that were happening and trying to like spin comedy gold out of some of the bad stuff, especially, yeah, I think it definitely has been a stand-in for therapy. I still don't go to therapy. I probably shouldn't admit that, but I still don't.
Listen, whatever you're doing is working. You sound unbelievably sorted. And you're not joking when you say that that's why you started writing, because on your blog, there's an introduction and it says that in 2008, this is you writing, "I started a blog on MySpace," do you even know what that is, "to convince this hot dude to be my boyfriend. He eventually dumped me and that was pretty terrible. But now I have a book on the New York Times bestseller list. Thank you, dude." And I just think that is so on brand for this podcast. It's like you took a failure and you made it a massive success. And I want to applaud you for that. But that does lead us on to your second.
I'm so happy to be dumped.
Yeah, exactly. Well, do you know what, Samantha? This podcast started after I got dumped. So I think we both have reasons to be grateful for those badly behaved twats. Technical term.
God, I could listen to you say twats all day.
Okay, again, another podcast. I love this because we're not actually seeing each other. We're recording remotely during lockdown and it gives it a whole added frisson.
This is great. I'm having the best time.
Me too. You're so lovely. That leads us on actually to your second failure, which is that you have had many, many failed relationships. I don't know which ones you'd like to focus on first. Is there one that sticks in the mind as being particularly a failure?
Well, in the book before this one, which is called We Are Never Meeting in Real Life, I wrote this essay called A Blues for Fred, and it's about my old boyfriend Fred, who, when I met him, I am from the watched too many episodes of Sex and the City and thought maybe like my life could be that kind of generation. When did that come out? Like 2005?
Too long ago. It doesn't feel that long ago, does it? Yeah.
No, it doesn't. It really doesn't. But I don't know if I thought this, but there was a part of me that hoped that there would be like some fairy tale person that would come along and I'd be like, yes, you. Yes. So then I met him and he was the first person I'd ever met who was put together. He had, you know, a house and a car, neither of them fancy, but they were like his, and there was no roommate. There was no like, my mom's upstairs, be quiet. And it was like, he'd had like towels, like more than one towel and more than one pillow. And that to me, it was like the first time I had or dated anyone who had multiple towel sets. And I was like, and he had a juicer, he had this really fancy juicer. And I was like, oh my God, this person has multiple towels and makes his own juice. This is it. This is the grown up that I have been waiting for. And I projected all of my hopes and dreams onto him, and I thought, I was like, oh, this is my person, this is gonna be great. And then it didn't work because he wanted a wife and children, and like the wife would stay at home and tend to the children, which was a surprise to me because I thought I could clock that kind of guy. I was like, oh, this is weird, okay, didn't expect this from you. And so it didn't end badly. It was just one of those things that's like, well, okay, you want, we've been at this for a couple of years and I'm not going to change my mind about crawling around on the floor chasing your children, and you're not going to change your mind about holding my suitcases while I go on tour to sell books about our life. So I guess, you know, we have to wrap this up. So yeah, that is my one big failed relationship. And I think it looms so large because it was like the first time I'd really like gotten my hopes up. And that sounds so heteronormative or fairy tale, or I mean, whatever term you can use to dismiss that kind of fantasy. Yeah. But it really was. I was like, oh, every rom-com that has imprinted on my brain led me to this moment. And then very quickly was like, oh, okay, we're not okay. And then we spent a lot of time like, maybe, maybe. And then ultimately it was just like, no, we should stop.
That's so fascinating because I think I went wrong in multiple relationships because I expected it to be like a rom-com and a specific diet of 1980s rom-coms like Working Girl or Pretty Woman, or where the man is always completing the woman's life in some integral way. And it took me a very long time to realize that that wasn't going to happen unless I first completed my own life in my own way and knew myself. I was like, but that takes so much more work. But
I know.
Yeah. What did you learn?
It's like,
from
if
that?
I'm already put together, what do I need you for, right?
Like, yes,
exactly. The missing piece.
Exactly. What do you think you learned from that relationship? Did you learn everything you needed to know, or did it take a succession of other failed relationships?
No, that was the last one, period, before I met my now wife. And it ended and I was like, okay, this was a big thing. I gotta just stop. I have to take down all my dating profiles and stop looking. Like, I need a celibacy break. I need to reassess what I'm looking for. Like, it felt so monumental to me that I had to completely stop. And so I did. I didn't date anyone. I didn't look for anyone. I didn't go back because, you know, there was a temptation right afterward to sift through all the rubble of my previous failed relationships and like see if I could resuscitate any of those. And I was like, nope, not going to do that. And then I got deeper into like trying to make my writing career happen. And I wrote the first version of my book, Meaty, and just dove into that as a distraction. Then after that book came out, I met my wife because she tweeted me about the book.
Wow, I didn't know that that's how you met.
Yes.
I love it.
Yeah. I don't know if Twitter is a good way to meet people. I would say no, but it worked out in this one instance for me. Like, she tweeted me about the book and I tweeted her back. And then we had a conversation, you know, a couple of tweet conversations. And then I was like, wait a minute, if we're going to keep talking, I would rather it not be in public where everyone can see it. And then we just started texting and built a long distance relationship from there. But yeah, after that one big heartbreak, I was like, okay, not doing this again.
And what was it about your now wife that was different? Because I know when I met my now boyfriend, and I feel like you and I have had quite a similar trajectory dating wise, and I also had like gone on a break and not done the profiles and all that sort of stuff because I was just so sick of it. And then I downloaded Hinge one day and Justin was the first person I met and the only person I went on a date with, and that's him. So we also met online. But I think because he was so decent and straightforward and good, I didn't recognize it as that because I was so unused to it. So it felt very unfamiliar to me and I didn't get it for ages. And I wonder if, did you have a similar thing with your wife?
It's like, I mean, it's almost like the exact same where you meet someone who's not trying to play a trick on you or lie to you or withhold. I've fallen into that trap a lot where, you know, someone is being intentionally withholding or, and you view it as mysterious and it's like, ooh, but really it's like, no, there's not much there. They're just an asshole. But
laughing so hard through relating.
Yeah. I mean, we've all been through it. I mean, that's my thing, is like, we have to say it so then other people can like feel like they can admit theirs too. I've been tricked by, you know, someone who I thought was mysterious but really was just a shithead. So Kirsten was nice and genuine and enthusiastic, all the things that I hadn't had before. And we built a friendship first, because it was long distance, so there was no kind of reckless jumping right into anything. And she just was interested in me and enthusiastic about not just me, but about like herself and life in general. And she's just a nice, good person. And that was so new and refreshing to me. And as we like started to talk more and more, it just felt like so natural. And I bet you can relate to this. I had been so conditioned, and I don't even know that I mean that in the bad way, but I had been so conditioned to expect, you know, butterflies and the heart dropping, stomach flipping, roller coaster feeling. And we never had that. It was always just like natural,
yes,
and comfortable and easy. And I didn't feel like I had to put on a show or be anything I wasn't. And that was new for me too, right? Like I was used to, okay, I gotta do this and I gotta be dazzling and I gotta whip out my best jokes. I always have to be on. And I never felt like that with her. And after a while, I was like, okay, maybe this is the feeling that I should have been looking to feel with someone, rather than the will they, won't they call me? Do they, don't they like me? Like from the outset, it was just like, hey, I like you. You're funny. I like what you do. You know, I dated a person once who was like, I don't understand why other people think you're funny.
Wow.
I dated that person for like a year and a half. So
was that a man?
Yes. Ugh. Yeah. I mean, this is why I try not to even talk to any men anymore in general. No, I'm just kidding.
The men who listen to this podcast are so lovely, but the other ones, let us not bother with.
Everyone listening to this knows I don't mean them.
Yeah.
But like, we're waiting for that feeling of, oh, I want to do a cartwheel because this person is so great. I'm like, maybe that's like not what you want. Maybe you don't want the person who makes you feel nervous or not good enough, or that you have to perform for them. Maybe it's the person who you're like, oh, hey, being around you is nice. I don't feel stressed. You're interesting. This is great.
I cannot tell you how much I agree. And I feel safe. Like, that's another thing. Yeah. Just you're not fearful.
Yes. The feeling that you might lose them, or that they might be seeing someone else, or that you might say the wrong thing. I mean, we dress that up as like excitement, but really it's just stress. It's just stress. And I'm like, why do I want to be with someone who stresses me out all the time? No way. I just want to be cool. And so I found that.
And Kirsten, your wife, has two children, and you outline in your book your parenting theories, and you call it, which I think is so brilliant, detachment parenting. And you talk a bit about stepmothers. Now, I used to be a stepmother, and my partner now has three children. And I so related to when you made the point that culturally there are no great stepmothers that I can immediately think of. They're all evil, wicked witches in fairy tales. And it's so unfair when you are one, because it's such a thankless task. You don't get any of the good stuff and you get all of the bad stuff. And that's why I'm a massive supporter of your theory of detachment parenting. So explain to us what it is.
It's basically that I am kind of a passive bystander most of the time. I mean, you don't tell them really anything or correct them. And occasionally you sweep in and do something cool, like take them to see a scary movie. You know, I'm buying these kids candy all the time, or I flew them out to LA when I was working. But other than that, so the upside of that, because that sounds like kind of like Blake and Maine, but the upside is that nothing that goes wrong with them can be my fault.
Yeah.
Nothing. Like, we're not cuddled up reading books every night, but also if they rob a gas station in the future, it won't be because of something I did. And I'll just be like, listen, I watched you from afar. I did not contribute to any of those bad things in your life.
And is your wife okay with it? Were you clear about how involved or not you would be beforehand?
Oh, yeah. Before I moved in, even. Like, we dated for a long time before I moved in, and I was clear. I mean, the thing is, they have two parents who love them, take care of them, and put them on a vaccine schedule and all the stuff that, like, parents are supposed to do, right? Like, get their allergies checked and all that other stuff. So they don't need me to do that, especially considering my limited knowledge of what a child actually needs. So I was like, listen, I'll be there. I'll do whatever you need me to do for you. You know, if they need me to get them a bike, I can do that. But like the parenting stuff, I'll leave to their actual parents. And like, everybody has been okay with that. I mean, I gotta knock on wood, but so far it's working out.
I love that. And then I think it makes it, everyone enjoys everyone else's company a lot more.
Yeah. You know, Elizabeth, my worst, I mean, I have many worst nightmares, but one of them, I mean, two of them around the kids are one that in the future they'll be like, this thing you wrote or said or did when I was 13 ruined my life forever. Like, that's one. But also, I have a very specific, like, horror fantasy of being, hey, wash the dishes. And then they turn around and are like, you're not my mommy.
Yeah.
And yes. I can't have that happen to me. I just can't. You know what I mean?
That's exactly the same thing.
That will haunt me. I can't do it. Yeah. I cannot do it. So I don't yell at, like, that kind of rejection. I don't know what I would do. It would never stop playing on a continuous loop in my head. I would just be like, remember that time she screamed, you're not my mommy, in your face? Like, it would torment me forever. So I do everything I can to avoid those kinds of interactions.
Are you happy not having your own biological children?
Yes. I mean, this is so rude, but I could walk away from these ones. I mean, maybe not even forever, right? But if they, you know, the one plays the drums, like, I could just, if he's on the drums for an hour, I can just, like, go get in the car and go away.
Yeah.
And if they were mine, I mean, you cannot leave your own biological children. I've never had the, even as a kid, I never had the, I want to be a mommy. I never had that. I don't know why. I mean, I'm sure there's like a therapist or psychologist listening who's like, I can figure out why. I want to say that part of it is that I had such a bad childhood for most of it that I don't want to risk doing that to another kid. So part of it is like that I wouldn't be able to provide the best life for a child. But then the other part is I like to sleep. I have no patience. I like to do what I want when I want. And you just can't if you have a kid. And I've never reached the age. Well, now I'm married to a woman and it would take a lot more work. But I never got to the age where, you know, people get to the age where they're like, okay, I'm ready to do this and sacrifice my needs for the needs of this child. That hasn't happened to me yet.
So your third failure, we're now moving from the profound to what seems quite ridiculous.
I have to pick a dumb one.
I know, but I love that. I love that you did that. I feel like it's just you're a born storyteller, because now we're going to end with a little palate cleanser, which is that once you failed a drama class because you were so uptight, which I can't imagine you being uptight.
Yeah. So that's when people are like, how can you be so open? I'm like, because when it's written down and you just kind of hand it to people in a book, That's one thing. Or if I'm doing a show and you come to see me read, that's another thing. But the act of like letting go in my body and inhabiting a character or doing something like dramatic, I mean, to circle back around to shame, that is a thing that makes me so embarrassed. I can't even function. So every time I have been forced to take a drama class or a movement class or anything like that, I never do well because I just like clam up. Any sort of emoting that isn't part of, you know, like a joke making kind of thing, I can't do it. I cannot.
Do you think that's because it feels inauthentic to you?
Yeah. I used to do a lot of storytelling shows in Chicago, and I definitely have a stage presence is the wrong word, but almost like a character, right? Like when, or like if you listen to my audiobook, you can hear that there's kind of the character of Samantha Irby that I am reading in. That's going to sound really creepy, but I'll just go with it.
Interesting. It sounds interesting.
So,
yeah.
So I can do that. I can be me doing a reading and like having a relationship with a listener. But anything other than that specific person, if I have to perform it, if you're like, be a sad woman who got caught outside in the rain, I can't, I cannot do it. Or be a happy little girl who just got her first puppy, I will just clam up. I can't do it.
And it was an actual specific drama class that you failed.
Yeah, I mean, my early 20s. I mean, it just was out of like boredom or something to do. I took this class that was like, you know, it had some like hippy dippy name, like freeing the body or, you know, something like that. And because my friend was like, let's do this. And, you know, I will do anything if it's like dumb enough. So I was like, okay, let's do this. And I went and I couldn't do any of the exercises. And of course, it's like low stakes. I paid for it. The grade or assessment doesn't matter. But and at the end, it was like a 6-week kind of thing. The teacher was just like, I did not expect that you would be the person who couldn't loosen up. But yeah, you were terrible. And I was like, you're deeply ashamed. I'm like, I'm so sorry. It's so bad that even if I were just thinking, like I'm alone in my dining room right now, just thinking if I had to pretend to be like someone crying, I couldn't even do it alone. So I don't know why. I think maybe I was more optimistic back then and thought that with the right teaching, I could be lured out of my acting shell, but no, I couldn't.
I totally agree with you, because I sometimes think of the fact that a lot of actors now audition by sending in recorded videos from their iPhone. And the idea of having to perform a scene with like full emoting just in front of your smartphone is tortuous to me. But you've hung around actual real life actors because you've written for television, most notably on Shrill, Lindy West's brilliant sitcom. And I wonder how you find it being around those kind of people. Do you find them sort of magical because they can do these things?
Yes, I'm in complete awe. Let me tell you, in the episode that I wrote, I'm in it. I don't know if that's a little Easter egg for anyone who watches episode 4 of Shrill. Huh. So just watching people on set, I just was like mystified. There's a scene where AD has to do this speech that I wrote about being fat and like struggling with her body her whole life, and she has to cry. And I watched her do the scene, like, you know, they make them do it like 12 times, and every time she had to cry, and she was so good and it was so believable. And I was like, I don't understand how you did that. And then Lindy and I are in a scene where we literally have to walk past other people, and I have on giant sunglasses. I look like a Secret Service agent, and I'm so stiff and weird. I was like, listen, if you want to cut me out, that's fine. I look terrifying. It's so bad. So yeah, watching people who can do that and be loose and free, I am in awe. I'm in awe.
I'm going to go back and watch episode 4 of Shrill. It'll be like when you see Hitchcock in his own films.
Yeah. I'll tell you to make it easier. I'm wearing a red dress.
Okay.
So you have
okay.
to like email me and let me know when you I find
will.
Me.
I will. I'm super excited. Although I know that you don't like replying to emails, because there is an extremely funny passage in your book where you talk about how sometimes, and you're not bigging yourself up, but you're like, sometimes I do get emails from people who kind of like my work, and either I ignore them for months on end and then they just disappear, or in a fit of admin, you decide to reply and then you get stuck. I think you call it like this endless loop of thank yous. And it made me laugh so much. I've been in so many of those endless loops where you do something nice and then you feel guilty for not replying to the reply to your reply.
I know. It's just like, when do we stop? When does it stop? Like, you thanked me, and so I want you to know that I saw it and I'm thanking you. But then if you circle around and think, it's like at that point you have to decide, are we going to be friends or should I just risk looking rude? It's hard. But I would respond to your email. And
you're
then
so
I'd respond lost. Back and be like, let's be friends.
Okay, can we?
But that's because
yes.
we've had this. I'm establishing a friendship here. I don't know what you're doing.
Me too. Me too. Let me allay any embarrassment you fear. I'm desperate to be your friend. I would love it.
Oh,
let's just email each other all the time about the Real Housewives of New York, because I'm always looking for someone just to endlessly dissect those programs with.
It's me. What do you think of the new girl, Leah?
I think she's great. And
me too.
Yeah, I didn't expect to, because I'm a bit Vicky Gunvalson about newcomers. I don't always take to them straight away. But I think Leah has made just a storming entrance. She's so good.
Me too. I love her.
And I love that she's bringing out a maternal side to Ramona. I'm so sorry for anyone who doesn't watch Real Housewives of New York. A, what are you doing? But B,
now.
Sorry about this. Yeah, exactly. They are. Yeah, they are.
We need to get you a Bravo sponsorship after this.
Stop! I mean, Andy Cohen would be my dream interviewee, as well as you. Joint equal with you.
It's just a matter of calls. We got to know somebody who knows somebody. The world is too small. I'm on it. I'll figure it out.
Thank you. You're so lovely. Samantha Irby, you have lived up to every single expectation I had and exceeded them. And I don't know how you've done that, because they were already sky high. And I just cannot thank you enough for being the delightful and brilliant person that you are.
Thank you for having me, Elizabeth. This was so great and so fun. I would do it every week. I mean, no, I know we can't, but I would if, you know, just saying. If you're ever looking for someone to talk to every week, I'm here for you.
Thank you. I'll see you this time next Tuesday. Thank you so, so much. I wanted to take a minute to introduce you to a new podcast that I am loving at the moment, because at this time, we need community and connection more than ever. Words and stories that bind us, not divide us. And that's why I am loving Anthems. It is a podcast of original manifestos, speeches, stories, and poems from some of the country's biggest activists, artists, and personalities, all contemplating what it means to be human. Season 2 just launched with 30 podcasts over 30 days in daily mini episodes from exclusively LGBTQI+ contributors, including Lottie Jeffs, Raven Smith, Shah Elise, and Ben Hunt. The episodes are a perfect addition to your morning routine at home. 30 podcasts over 30 days in daily mini episodes from exclusively LGBTQI+ contributors. All about what it is to be human. You just can't get better content than that. Search Anthems now wherever you listen to podcasts, and check out the new season dropping daily across the month of June. If you enjoyed this episode of How to Fail with Elizabeth Day, I would so appreciate it if you could rate, review, and subscribe. Apparently, it helps other people know that we exist.